Coming home at night had never been a problem for me. The streets in my neighborhood were quiet, almost deserted after 10 o'clock. But that night was different. I had worked overtime at the coffee shop, and the clock was almost midnight when I left. The walk to my apartment was straight ahead, 5 blocks in a straight line. The first 2 passed without incident. But as I rounded the corner to the 3rd, I saw him. A man in his 40s, wearing a dark jacket and a cap that barely showed his face. Standing on the corner, he was doing nothing, just looking in my direction. I kept walking, picking up the pace a little. But when I crossed the street, I noticed that he did too. My heart began to beat faster. I tried to convince myself that it was a coincidence, but the uncomfortable feeling grew when I looked over my shoulder and saw him at the same distance walking in my direction. There was no way of knowing what he wanted. He said nothing, did nothing. He just followed my footsteps, like a ghost who didn't bother to hide his presence. He wasn't running. He wasn't coming any closer. He was just keeping his distance, enough for me to know he was watching me. I turned sharply into an alley I used to use as a shortcut. It was dark and narrow, but at least it would get me closer to home faster. As I moved forward, I heard something that made me stop in my tracks. Quick footsteps behind me, but they were not from the man who had been following me. As I turned, I saw a young man with his face covered by a scarf. Before I could react, he pushed me against the wall. His breath reeked of alcohol, and his hand squeezed me tightly as he pulled out a knife. "Give me everything you got." This person was very dangerous. He was wild-eyed. His voice was broken, and I remember the particular detail that his mouth was quite close to me. I had no choice. I pulled out my wallet and my phone and handed them to him, begging him to let me go. But he didn't. He pushed me harder and whispered something that made my blood run cold. "I'm not done with you yet."
"Please don't."
"The night is very long and precious, and this place is very empty. Perfect for us to be happy for a few hours." Before I could process the horror within his words, I heard a thud behind him. A thud like a sledgehammer against flesh. The man who had been following me was there, and he didn't seem willing to stand idly by. Without warning, he threw a punch at the assailant that sent him staggering to the side. The knife fell to the ground with a clink. There was no time for the assailant to react. The man grabbed his head and slammed it against the wall with brutal force. The attacker tried to defend himself, but it was useless. The man in the jacket hit him again and again, precisely and mercilessly. I could hear the crunching of bones and the choked screams of the young man. I realized at that moment I was paralyzed, unable to move or say anything. Finally, the assailant's body fell to the ground. He wasn't dead, but he could barely move. He gasped. His face covered in blood and his nose broken at a grotesque angle. The man leaned over him and said something I didn't hear. Then, he raised his head and looked at me. It was then that my instinct screamed at me to run. I didn't think of anything else. I turned and ran as fast as I could, out of the alley and back to the main street. I didn't dare look back, but I knew he was coming after me. His footsteps were slower than mine, but steady. His voice broke the silence, calm but threatening.
"You don't have to be afraid of me. I don't have any interest in you."
I had no idea what he meant by that. My mind was completely blank, focused solely on getting home. As I rounded the last corner, I could see the door to my building. I pulled my keys out of my pocket with trembling hands and barely managed to get inside before I closed the door behind me. He was there. Standing in the dim light of the street lamp. He was watching me, unmoving, with an expression I couldn't decipher. I could see something in his hand. It was my belongings. He just threw them on the ground indifferently and left. Before doing so, he raised his hand as if greeting me, as if giving me the understanding that there wouldn't be any problem, which from my side was impossible to believe. A few minutes later, the police arrived. My things were still there, outside the apartment. I asked one of the policemen to get my things. I really didn't plan on going out alone at all. It was days before I could sleep peacefully. But even then, the image of that man wouldn't leave me. Who was he? Why had he attacked the thief but then followed me? There was something in his eyes that I couldn't get out of my head. It wasn't madness, but it wasn't normalcy either. It didn't take me long to search for answers. I spent hours on forums and social networks, searching for news about similar attacks. Finally, I found a name. Pedro Rodriguez Filho. The article spoke of a man who described himself as a vigilante, someone who killed only those he considered guilty. But he was also a murderer, one who enjoyed what he did. The more I read, the more I became obsessed. I found interviews where he talked about his mission. And in every word, I could see the man who had saved me. My mind was divided. One part of me was grateful, but the other couldn't ignore what he really was. Not a hero, but a monster with his own moral code. Now as I write this, I know I'll never forget that night. Pedro Rodriguez Filho is no ordinary man, nor is he a hero. He's a reminder that evil does not always present itself in obvious ways. He died a few years ago, but his story lives on, both in the news and in the collective memory of Brazil, our country. Many say the man was a hero, others a murderer. His last victim was someone who, according to him, deserved it. But when I think of him, I can't help but wonder, where does justice end and evil begin? And who has the right to decide that? The only thing I know is that that night, Pedro helped me. But he didn't do it because he was a good Samaritan, but because he was a killing machine who quenched his thirst for bad people. The story is based on the crimes of Pedro Rodriguez Filho, one of Brazil's most notorious serial killers. Known as Pedrinho Matador, or Little Pedro the Killer, Rodriguez Filho began his murderous spree at the age of 14. Over the years, he claimed to have killed over 100 people, including criminals, drug dealers, and even his own father. Rodriguez Filho often targeted those he deemed as bad people, which led to a twisted sense of vigilante justice. His first known murder was at 14 when he killed the vice mayor of his town for firing his father. Rodriguez Filho's killing spree continued unabated until his arrest in 1973. Despite being incarcerated, his violent tendencies did not wane. He killed numerous fellow inmates. In total, he was convicted of 71 murders and received a sentence of 128 years in prison. However, like in the previous story, Brazil laws limits the maximum time a person can serve to 30 years, so he was released in 2007.
My name is Ane, and I have to tell you a horrible story. But more importantly, a true story. I'm not telling it because I want to scare or impress anyone, but because it is a mark that I carry in my body and my mind. This is not something I heard on a newscast or a small-town rumor. It is my own nightmare come true, something that lived in every atom of my being. I was 14 years old when it all happened. I lived in a small town in Colombia, one of those places where everyone knows everyone else. My parents had warned me about strangers, of course, as all parents do, but it was not a place where we were really afraid. There was almost nothing in town, and that included visible dangers. It was a normal afternoon. I had gone out to the market to buy a few things for my mom. A simple list, rice, beans, and a package of cookies. I took a different way back because I had heard that you could save a few minutes if you went through an alley near the old school. It seemed like a good idea. It was early and still sunny. I didn't see it coming. When I think about how it all happened, I sometimes blame myself for being so trusting. But how was I supposed to know what to expect? Here I was, supposed to be in a safe place. I first saw him right at the end of the alley. He was dressed in a brown jacket and a hat that looked like a peddler's hat. He had a package in his hand and a clipboard under his arm. He was thin with small eyes and a thin mustache that twisted when he smiled. He spoke to me with a strange kindness, too calculated not to be suspicious.
"Hello, girl. Could you help me with something real quick? I'm looking for Mr. Ramirez's house. I was told he lived nearby."
I stopped because, although I didn't recognize the name he mentioned, something in his tone made me doubt. But I didn't want to be rude. I told him I didn't know any Ramirez. Instead of leaving, he smiled wider and took a step toward me.
"Oh, don't worry. Maybe I wrote it down wrong. By the way, my name is Tomas. It's nice to meet such polite young people."
I didn't shake his hand. Something wasn't right, but how could I justify that feeling without seeming rude? I looked down and said I was in a hurry and that my mom was waiting for me.
"I understand. Moms always want to have everything ready, don't they? Would you mind if I walk with you for a bit? This road is very lonely."
Before I could answer, he already had closed the distance between us. He smiled at me again. The first movement was quick, a strong hand on my right arm pulling me toward him. I tried to scream, but his other hand covered my mouth. It was as if he had practiced this move hundreds of times. The market bag fell to the ground and the beans scattered on the dusty floor.
Hey, it's okay. I don't want to hurt you."
He was lying. I knew it in every fiber of my being. I squirmed, trying to free myself, but his grip was firm. He dragged me to a corner of the alley where there was an old wooden gate. He opened it with ease, as if he already knew the place. Behind the gate was an unkept lot full of weeds. The man took me quickly. He no longer seemed friendly. Now he was carrying me as if I were the shopping bag. I was terrified, but I wasn't going to allow myself to be caught without a fight. I managed to bite his hand, just enough for him to loosen his grip a little. I screamed at the top of my lungs, hoping someone would hear me. He didn't seem scared or nervous. He grabbed my shoulder and threw me to the ground. My plan had failed.
"If you scream, it will be worse. You don't want this to be worse."
He dragged me toward an old shed on the grounds. It was a small, dark place with a door barely held on rusty hinges. He pushed me inside and closed the door behind him.
"Don't worry. This won't take long."
I tried to back up but tripped over something on the floor. It was a broken bottle. I grabbed it quickly without thinking and lifted it as a weapon. Tomas smiled, not with surprise but with something that looked like amusement. Laughing, he advanced towards me, thinking that I would not dare to attack him. And without thinking twice, I lashed out with the bottle. The glass cut his hand, but I didn't get to see the blood since I took advantage of that moment to run away as fast as I could. I ran to the door, but it was locked with a padlock. The force of fear gave me the energy to try and break it. Tomas approached slowly, holding his wounded arm. I tried to find something to use as a tool, anything that would help me break the lock or defend myself. I felt my breathing quicken as my hands roamed for the door, looking for some way out. Behind me, his footsteps were slow, but sure. He seemed to enjoy every second as if the mere sight of me in despair was enough to fuel him. When he finally stopped a few feet away from me, he spoke again.
"You know, girl, I always wondered what goes through someone's mind when they're cornered. Is it fear? Or maybe hope? Do you think you're going to get out of here?"
I found a piece of old wood near the door and used it to hit the lock with all of my might. I hit it as hard as I could, but the lock wouldn't budge. I turned quickly and faced him with the wood up, ready to hit him if he came any closer.
"Go ahead. Give it a try."
In a desperate move, I threw the wood towards his face. It didn't hit him directly, but it was enough to make him turn away for an instant. I took advantage of the moment to push with all of my might on the door. The frame creaked, and although the padlock continued to resist, finally one of the hinges gave way. I managed to open a small space and slipped through just as he tried to catch me. I ran without looking back, hearing his footsteps following close behind me. My mind was focused only on moving forward, on getting away from that place.
I didn't expect you to be able to get away, girl, but I'll find you. I know where you live. I'll catch you. You'll see. Now you've brought your whole family into this.
Ignoring him, I ran and ran. I don't remember how I got to the main road, but I did. A passing truck driver saw me and slammed on his brakes. I could barely speak. I just pointed to where I was coming from, hoping he would understand. The man called the police, and although they searched the area, they couldn't find Tomas. He had disappeared. After that day, my life changed forever. For weeks, I couldn't sleep. Every shadow, every noise in the night made me think that he was there, waiting for me. But eventually, over time, I learned to move on. I never stopped looking over my shoulder, though. Years later, when I heard his name on the news, I froze. Luis Alfredo Gravito, known as the Beast, had been captured. Seeing his face on television confirmed what I had always suspected. I had not been his only victim, but I was one of the few who managed to escape. Now, every time I see his picture or hear his story, I feel a chill. Not because I fear him, but because I know that there are real monsters out there. They don't have horns or fangs. They have quiet smiles and soft words. And sometimes, just sometimes, you manage to escape them.
This story is based on the crimes of Luis Alfredo Gravito, one of the most prolific and infamous serial killers in history. Known as the Beast, Gravito was a Colombian man who, during the 1990s, lured, tortured, and murdered over 190 children and teenagers. Posing as a priest, teacher, or charity worker, he would approach vulnerable boys, gain their trust, and offer them money or gifts before leading them to isolated locations. There, he subjected them to unspeakable acts of violence before killing them. Garavito's reign of terror ended in 1999 when he was arrested after the discovery of mass graves containing the remains of his victims. During his trial, he confessed to his crimes in horrifying detail, leading to a conviction with a cumulative sentence of over 1,800 years in prison, though Colombian law capped his sentence at 40 years. The case exposed critical failures in Colombia's justice system and raised questions about the rehabilitation and punishment of such criminals.
My name is Claire Bennett, and before that night, my life was pretty normal. I work as a paramedic in a small hospital in Angarsk, a seemingly quiet place. My days were filled with routine, common emergencies, and quick dinners at home while watching television. Although Angarsk had a reputation for being a safe place, there were always rumors and stories people told to scare the gullible, missing women and bodies found in the nearby woods. I put it down to exaggerated tales. It was easier to live ignoring what you couldn't control. However, everything changed when I met Michael. He was nothing special at first glance, a stocky man with thinning hair and a smile that didn't reach his eyes. I met him one night at the hospital. He came with a police uniform and a woman who looked like she needed help. He said he had found her on the road, alone and disoriented. We obliged and took care of the woman, who kept mumbling unintelligible things. Michael stayed for a while, chatting with me. He was kind, almost charming, but there was something in his gaze that made me uncomfortable. I didn't think anything of it. After all, he was a police officer, someone who was supposed to protect us. The disappearances began to pile up over the next few weeks. First, it was a young woman who used to shop at the store across the street from my house. Then, a nurse at the hospital. always women, always found in the woods, if they were found at all. The authorities kept everything under control, or so they said. However, among the paramedics and nurses, the panic was starting to grow. I tried to remain calm, but every time I left the hospital late and walked through the deserted streets, I felt a pang of paranoia. One night, after a grueling shift, I received a message from my friend and co-worker, Laura. She asked me to stop by her house because she wasn't feeling well. It was rare for Laura to ask for help. She had always been quite reserved. I decided to go. Her house was about 20 minutes from mine, and even though it was late, I was confident I could get there quickly in my car. When I arrived, the door was ajar. I knocked on Laura's door, but there was no answer. I entered carefully, thinking she might have fainted. The room was in semi-darkness, with a lamp knocked over on the floor. Everything seemed too quiet. I climbed the stairs, and when I reached his room, the air froze in my lungs. The bed was empty, but there was a trail of blood leading to the bathroom. Before I could react, I heard a rustling sound behind me. I turned around, but there was no one there. Just the feeling that something or someone was too close. That night, I couldn't sleep. I reported what I had seen at Laura's house to the police, but they seemed more interested in reassuring me than taking me seriously. She probably went out somewhere and had a minor accident, one of the officers said, but I knew something wasn't right. I decided to investigate on my own. I checked the local news, reports of disappearances, and, with some desperation, even internet forums. I found nothing concrete, only wild theories and assumptions. However, in several comments, one name kept coming up, the Angarsk Maniac. The name sounded ridiculous to me, but something in the description reminded me of Laura. Could she have fallen into the hands of this man? The thought was frightening, but more disturbing was remembering the trail of blood in her house. I decided to search the nearby woods, a place many feared to enter, but which, rumor had it, was his hunting ground. That same night, with a flashlight and my phone, I drove to the outskirts of town. I left the car on a trail and walked deeper into the forest. I was not prepared for what I found. A few meters away, under a tree, I saw something that made me shiver. A red scarf, identical to the one Laura used to wear. As I picked it up, I heard a noise in the trees. As I turned around, I saw a figure in the darkness, watching me. I don't know how long I stood still trying to decipher what or who that figure was. Finally, I decided to slowly back up to my car. I didn't run, I didn't want to provoke whatever was there. When I got to the car and looked back into the woods, the figure had disappeared. I drove back to town, my mind full of questions. Had it been him, the maniac? And if it was, what did he want from me? That night, I checked my home security cameras, paranoid about what I had seen. The next morning, I found something even worse, a note on my windshield. It simply said, "I know who you are." I decided enough was enough. Laura was missing, but I was no cop, no detective. I was afraid, a paralyzing fear that wouldn't let me sleep or think clearly. I had done everything I could to help, and now I felt like I was up against something much bigger than I could handle. My survival instinct was screaming at me to stop. So I decided to stop looking, stop meddling. I told myself that if I walked away, so would the danger. However, that hope quickly crumbled. Days after I found the note on my windshield, I began to notice strange things. A shadow that seemed to move outside my window. Footsteps on the deserted streets on my way home from the hospital. One night, I found my door slightly ajar when I got home, though I was sure I had locked it. Fear began to take over my life. I tried to convince myself that it was all a figment of my imagination, but one early morning, I confirmed it. I was in my kitchen pouring myself water when I heard a dull thud in my backyard. With my heart hammering in my chest, I grabbed a knife and slowly opened the curtain. There, in the darkness, I saw a motionless figure wearing a hat that hid his face. After looking at me, He simply walked away. Fear made me a prisoner in my own home, but the worst was yet to come. The sound of his footsteps slowly faded away, leaving me alone in the bathroom. The silence was deafening, but I dared not move. With my heart hammering in my chest, I put my ear to the door, trying to catch any sign that he was still there. But all I heard was the creaking of wood on the first floor, followed by absolute silence. For a few seconds, I thought he was gone. Then, a strange smell came to me. At first, it was faint, almost imperceptible, but it soon became unmistakable. Smoke. My mind clouded with terror as I realized what was happening. The house was on fire. I screamed for help, banging desperately on the bathroom door. Smoke began to seep under the door, filling the small room in a matter of seconds. I coughed as I tried to remain calm, but each breath was heavier than the last. The thought of dying there, alone, tracked by a man I didn't even know, gripped me. I sat on the floor, my back against the wall, trying to conserve what little clean air was left. Suddenly, a rumble shook the house. A few seconds later, I heard voices on the other side of the bathroom door.
Claire, are you there?
It was the voice of one of my neighbors. I started screaming, banging on the door with what little strength I had left. I felt three men trying to open it from the outside as the fire roared around me. Finally, with a loud bang, the door gave way and a pair of hands pulled me out. As I stepped outside, fresh air filled my lungs. Outside, a crowd of neighbors had gathered, watching my house go up in flames. I collapsed on the grass, crying and coughing, as firefighters arrived to put out the blaze. After that night, I had nothing left. My house was destroyed and my life was broken. I decided it was time to start over, away from that place. I moved to another town, changed my name, and tried to rebuild my life. Every night I checked all the locks, making sure I was safe. It was months before I could sleep without nightmares. It was during one of those nights, while watching the news, that his face appeared on the screen. Michael, the policeman who had brought the disoriented woman to the hospital. They had found hard evidence that he was responsible for the disappearances and murders in Angarsk. From what they said on the news, Michael said that no one had ever survived him. We both know it was a lie. I had survived. I wondered why he lied, and at that moment I thought to myself, what if he was hiding my existence and then came looking for me? After that, I tried to keep my profile as low as possible, but I will be honest. I don't care that Michael is serving a life sentence. I won't be in peace until he's dead. This story is based on the crimes committed by Michael Popkov. Known as the Wolfman in Angarsk, Popkov was a Russian police officer who used his position of authority to commit a series of horrific murders between 1992 and 2010. His modus operandi involved approaching women, gaining their trust, then kidnapping them, ultimately killing them and leaving their bodies in remote areas of the Siberian region of Angarsk. His story is marked by the perversity of his crimes and the fact that, for years, he managed to evade justice. It is estimated that he was responsible for at least 78 deaths. Popkov was arrested in 2012 after an investigation finally linked him to the murders. In 2015, he was convicted of 22 murders, but in 2018, after further questioning, he confessed to an additional 56 killings. Throughout his trial, authorities discovered that his motivation was not just the satisfaction of his sadistic desires, but also a twisted moral justification. He believed he was purifying women he deemed immoral. The verdict was harsh, and Popkov was sentenced to life in prison.